You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Eureka! Did you build the smelloscope? No, I remembered that I built one last year. Go ahead, try it. You'll find that every heavenly body has its own particular scent. Here, I'll point it at Jupiter.
Smells like strawberries.
Exactly. And now, Saturn.
Pine needles. Oh, man, this is great. Hey, as long as you don't make me smell Uranus.
I don't get it.
I'm sorry, Fry, but astronomers renamed Uranus in 2620 to end that stupid joke once and for all.
Oh, what's it called now?
Urectum.
Me, 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 me.
Me, 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 me. I can't sing. I'm not a singer.
Me, 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 me.
I'm not a singer. I'm not a dancer. I'm just this guy.
That's okay.
You ever watch that TV show Cheers?
Yes. It's the depressing one about a bunch of guys in a bar.
It's a fantastic comedy. Anyway, the assistant bartender, the old guy coach, I'm saying I'm not a singer. I'm not a dancer. Anyway, he proposed to a woman once, and his speech was, "I'm not a smart man. I'm not a rich man. I'm not a tall man. I'm not a mailman. I'm not a gingerbread man." He's going, because he's so out of it. I love that scene. He's adorable. Anyway, he's an ancient dude and he's funny.
Ah, wow. Well, speaking of ancient, today we will be talking about how what tools we use, the tools that humanity has discovered and developed to study the ancient universe.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the evolution, I guess you could say, of telescopes.
Evolution. I'm just picturing like a Darwinian style evolution of like the
millions
the
of
small...
years ago, this long tube with some kind of a lens crawled out of a primordial lake.
It slithered out. No. It's like a long telescope slithering out of the water, developing a stand, evolving into a Dobsonian, and then taking flight as a space-based telescope.
As I was doing research for this episode, and this is a very storied story about how telescopes came to be and the technology improved, whatever, I kept thinking about Star Wars and Jedis, because in Jedis, or sorry, Star Wars, a Jedi's training is complete when he's built his own lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day, astronomers had to build their own telescopes. And it was like the final tool that they needed to start doing their insanely cool observations. So I kept thinking, like, ooh, Galileo, you have your own light. You have your own telescope. It is very good. Kepler, oh my God. You made a high-powered telescope. Ooh.
Yeah, Kepler was the Mace Windu of astronomers. His
telescope was pink. Purple.
You've kind of led me to an epiphany, because what's interesting is, as an astronomer, I often think about this, because building a radio telescope is the sort of thing that there are a bunch of really cool DIY ways of doing. I have a friend who built a radio telescope in his backyard using an old oil drum, like one of those,
really,
like olive oil drums, just using that as a feed horn to kind of collect radio waves, and then you have a digitizer, connect that to your computer, use a bit of software, and whammo, there you go. And so I often thought about it, but I think these days, with like professional level telescopes, and this probably applies all across the electromagnetic spectrum, so whatever wavelength you're observing, the leading edge telescopes are such massive undertakings from a logistical and from a financial perspective, that right. It's, you know, collaboration of multiple countries, governments, universities, labs, blah, blah, blah. But I think the thing that every astronomer does generally do to kind of, you know, get their wings or to build their lightsaber is to write their own code package for analysis of the telescope data. So that's the evolution, I think.
Oh, so now we've gone from building our telescopes to building the way we analyze the data from the telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. Cool. Sorry,
that was more like a home improvement sound rather than a cheers sound, if we're already referencing shows from last millennium.
Wow, we've referenced in, well, so we got, so far we've covered Cheers, Star Wars, and Home Improvement. Love this. Just minutes in
without having done an intro, so I should welcome all of our listeners and and the watchers to another absolutely chaotic episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist with everybody's favorite nerd / scientist, Benjamin Salas, and everybody's second favorite nerd / scientist, myself, Coffee Rose. What's up?
How are you doing?
I'm doing
good. Oh, no,
good.
I dropped my duck.
Dropped his Got duck.
It. I have
this
it.
This is why you can't have nice things, Coffee. Anyway.
Yes, today's episode, Benjamin. What have we got?
Today we're talking about, we already said what we're talking about, but now we're telling you about it again. We're talking about the evolution of telescopes. I'm going to start us off 4,000 years ago in ancient Greece.
No.
Archaeologists have found just all over many dwellings and other places of business or social places of ancient Greece, lots of objects resembling lenses, glass lenses. And it's not known if they were just decorative pieces or if they were kept around in private homes as some sort of like a focal point, a curiosity of, or a novelty item for when people came over. But they did they did have optical properties. And in the 5th century BCE, Ptolemy wrote about these water-filled spheres that our ancestors loved to use to look through and change their perspective of things far away. So it was, or was not, possibly the beginnings of what could have contributed towards using lenses of sorts to look far away.
Interesting.
Yeah. So a long time ago, but nothing really came to be yet of anything that looks like a telescope that we know them today for many hundreds of years later.
Right. I was going to say, it's like we had all of this, exploratory glass work that was, I guess, mostly for the S's and G's, just for like entertainment to see, oh, we can do a cool thing, or you can look through it and it does weird stuff. And then for basically like 1,000 years, we just said, no, we don't care about that at all.
Right. In the 13th century, in northern Italy, Nicholas of Cusa, he invented concave lenses for eyeglasses to try and correct nearsightedness. And these lenses were quite thick. And just as a happenstance, happened to notice by accident, a couple of them in a row, you were able to change your field of view in weird ways. Nothing controlled yet, but it was an observation. And it was in 1538 that an Italian scholar by the name of Professor Girolamo Fracastoro, I'm so good with these languages, he combined eyeglass lenses in such a way that he could make the moon or another star seem as if they would appear not much further away than the towers. that's how they described it. It's kind of nice. So it was the first time lenses and eyeglasses were used on celestial objects to make them look a little bit clearer, but not exactly a telescope. This is just positioning lenses. There's a theory that Girolamo Fracastoro did this in according to the sketches laid down by Leonardo da Vinci, but there's no proof to that just yet.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. And so then how did we get from people who are basically early optometrists messing around with lenses to Galileo? Or was Galileo then just like the first guy to actually say, put them together in a coming tube?
That happened 70 years later in 1608. It's the first official record of a telescope, and it occurred in the Netherlands, where another eyeglass maker is by the name of Hans Lippershey. He filed a patent for the very first time for his instrument that he said is for seeing things far away as if they were nearby. And a few weeks later, another inventor in the Netherlands by the name of Jacob Metius tried to file a patent for the exact same thing. Both use a combination of convex and concave lenses, and they were able to achieve a magnification of up to about 3 times. And shortly after that, a year later, word of this spyglass spread like crazy all across Europe in 1609. And in 1609, there is this dude on vacation in Venice. His name is Galileo Galilei. And he got his hands on one of these things. And the day he returned home, he figured out by himself how to completely recreate it. And the next day, he actually did build it using a combination of lenses on either end of a tube and an eyepiece that he fashioned on his own. This is just from memory. And it was better than the one he sampled in Venice, and he presented it to the highest authority in Venice at the time, who rewarded him with a job and doubled his salary as in his teaching salary, I believe. And then he kept on improving his telescope, and he got it all the way up to 23 times magnification. And that's the one he decided for the first time, well, I'm going to point it at the stars. And that's when he got the first observations of Jupiter's moons, phases of Venus, spots in the sun, etc. That's how we got to that.
It's interesting cuz so like I've seen some of Galileo's early telescopes at the Galileo Museum in Florence or Firenze in Italy, and they're quite large. It's kind of like I don't know, like imagine taking one of those telephone poles or light poles that you see on like the side of a road, and maybe taking a third of that. So they're quite thick, they're quite long, and I'm just picturing like, yeah, we knew how to track the motion of the planet since the time of the ancient Greeks, if not before that, especially if you're looking at other cultures outside of the Western or European world. But then I'm just picturing like shifting one of these massive early Galilean telescopes towards Jupiter or towards any of the planets with no expectation that you would suddenly see a bunch of things orbiting around it.
Right.
Like it's mind blowing.
Telescopes for the longest time after Galileo recreated a telescope. The idea was in order to make them better, you had to make them, as Kavi, you just said, longer. And so there were people making telescopes that were 20, 30, sometimes even 40 feet long. And they were these massive, massive things. And that was the only way people thought we can increase clarity, we can increase resolution, we can increase the magnification, and it required this large supporting structure with pulleys and other apparatus, and some of them even with a crew to help you position and then even hold by hand a telescope in a certain position so that the observer can see Jupiter, which is, I mean, they didn't know at the time. This was just this, it was the latest technology at the time. It was actually quite huge. That, well, huge because they're huge.
telescopes. It's interesting how every wave of like telescope, I'm sure you have this in your notes, I have no doubt, and we'll get to it, but it's interesting how I guess every wave of telescope design or telescope style is like, oh, this is the new thing. Let's see how big we can make it. Right. Realizing that you hit a point and it's like, okay, this is too long or too wide or too whatever to be physically possible or feasible or reasonable from an engineering perspective. And then a new style is created or a new genre, if you will, of telescopes. But yeah, sorry, right. No spoilers.
Let's see my notes. Christian Huygens, along with his brother, built a massive telescope that was 12 feet long, but it was also several feet wide. And that's what he used to discover Saturn's moon Titan. And also helped him really see with great clarity for the first time Saturn's rings. And it gets bigger. In 1652, an Italian Jesuit astronomer by the name of Niccolo Zucchi wrote for the very first time about the existence of a refracting telescope, which shortens the length of the telescope by creating inside of a tube a mirror at one end, which bends things back into another focal point. And Newton, it was a reflecting telescope. And then in 1668, Newton completed the very first, earliest functioning, perfectly reflecting telescope. And he was also the first to use an alloy of tin and copper to make the mirror, which was smoother, easier to fashion, and gave a much, much clearer picture in 1668. And it's very nice. It's a good telescope.
It's impressive.
I have something kind of like that
over there. Nice. Yeah, for folks listening at home, the main two types of telescopes, like from this point on, were either refractors or reflectors. So a refractor, basically, you have a lens at the far end of the telescope, and the light hits the lens and refracts through it and gets focused at a focal point, whereas a reflecting telescope, it basically it's like empty or open at the far end, and then normally at the kind of the business end of the telescope, close to the observer, is a large mirror that then collects all that light and focuses it at a focal point that's then directed out to the observer.
It's very cool.
I love it.
It's counterintuitive when you think about it. You have this large tube and it looks like it's in the way, this mirror that's in the middle of the view area. That should block your view. You should have a big black dot in whatever you're observing. But no.
it's almost like light is a wave that can interfere with itself. Dun, dun, dun.
You're smart.
Should we pause for an ad?
Yeah, let's pause for an ad. We still have centuries more of telescope innovation to get to.
Say, Benjamin, are you tired of looking up at the stars and wondering what they smell like?
Oh, God, I'm exhausted.
Well, I have good news, because today we are introducing the revolutionary Centroscope, the world's first telescope that lets you smell the cosmos. is Is Mars a bit musty? Does Jupiter have a cheesy aroma? Find out with a centroscope. Just point it at any celestial body, take a deep breath, and prepare to be astounded. The centroscope, because sometimes seeing isn't enough. Your nose knows.
Just don't aim it at Io.
Or Uranus.
Oh, God.
Sorry, I had to.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I love that Futurama joke. For those people who don't know much about Futurama, it's a funny cartoon about this guy from the year 2000 who suddenly finds himself in the year 3000 and he's the dumbest man alive. And they're looking at planets or talking about planets or something, and then he makes a joke about Uranus and he hides a snicker to himself. And then the professor that he's related to somehow, he goes, "My goodness, Fry, we've changed the name of that planet once and for all to get rid of that stupid joke. It's not Uranus anymore. What is it? Erectum." Love that joke.
It gets me every time. Also, if we want to talk about funny references to planets in our solar system, you mentioned briefly before about the discovery of the rings of Saturn. Mm-hmm. And I listened to a podcast recently called The Constant, which is presented and produced by a fellow named Mark Chrysler from Chicago. And The Constant is brilliant, highly recommended. This is an unpaid ad / plug for The Constant. But this particular episode that he did recently talks about our understanding, humanity's understanding of the rings of Saturn, what we first thought they were, because we didn't conceptually understand what a ring of a planet would be. Where would it come from? Was it a natural formation? Was it some sort of mythical, spiritual thing? I won't spoil it for you, but highly recommend checking out that new episode of The Constant.
You have actually told me about that podcast, and I have enjoyed it. I haven't listened to it for a spell. So
it's good.
We'll definitely go back for that one.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the evolution of the telescope. So the telescope is now... It's slithered out of the post-Cambrian goo, and or I should say the Calabrian, given like the strong Italian presence in the early history. So it's not Cambrian, it's Calabrian. And there was this renaissance from Calabria in Italy, like the chilies. And so we have gone from people playing around with glass to glasses manufacturers playing around with glasses to... now we have two types of telescopes. We have both refractors and reflectors. Newton is involved. Stuff is starting to get serious. What happens next?
Let's see. Sharpness is still an issue in 1672. Mm-hmm. And even though we had two types of telescopes, people are still building them ridiculously long. Giovanni Cassini discovered Saturn's fifth satellite with a telescope that was 35 feet long. And astronomer Johannes Hevelius built one almost 150 feet long, which was impossible to maintain. And so people were starting to condense things into smaller and smaller objects. Where was I? Am I reading? Let's see. the Cassegrain reflector was created in 1672 by Laurent Cassegrain. Mm-hmm. The telescope was a small convex hyperboloidal secondary mirror placed near the prime focus to reflect light through a central hole in the main mirror. So instead of a telescope which gathers light at the base, shoots it back up towards a mirror that then reflects the image out the side to an eyepiece. This is a telescope that gathers light at the base, reflects it towards a mirror at the top, which then condenses even smaller back towards a hole in the bottom of the base. So if you can imagine a big, like, what is it, a Dobsonian telescope, this big giant cylinder thing, but with a hole at the bottom, and you put your face up against the base of this monstrosity, and the light goes straight to you. It's actually quite handy, but it's difficult to maintain. It's easier to look at something from the side as opposed to laying down underneath this big water heater.
But yeah, I guess the cool thing was that it's no longer like that. You have an additional focal point, so you're not just relying on, like, you know, the reflector or refractor, the primary one, focusing all the light at a single point, and then just, you know, using a flat mirror to reflect that light out to an observer. That secondary mirror actually has a functional role, which is refocusing the light and sharpening it again.
Right. Then we start getting towards a point where people are starting to try new things. Christian Huygens and his brother Constantine Huygens created an aerial telescope. There's no more tube, just a long series of lenses, all properly suspended, that they're all in line with each other. Very difficult also to maintain, because now that they're all exposed, anything can make them wobble. So you can get them very, very long. And then the idea of making the mirror that gathers the light wider. Instead of making these telescopes longer, you can make them wider. William Herschel, in 1789, built a massive reflecting telescope with a 40-foot focal length, which he used to discover lots of things, including erectum. The Leviathan of Parsonstown, which was created by William Parsons. It was a 72-inch reflecting telescope. Was the largest telescope of its time and led to discovery of spiral galaxies. So now we're getting big things looking at very, 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 very far away.
Yep. And
in 1885, a blacksmith by the name of Dr. Emmett Brown fixed the telescope of the local school teacher in Hill Valley, California. And together,
Doc Brown?
Huh?
Is that Doc Brown?
But yeah, Dr. Emmett Brown.
Great Scott.
Yeah. I was doing the research and all these times were 1880s, and I'm like, wait. I remember a telescope thing.
Love it. 1888, exactly.
1885, thank you.
Sorry, it was 88 miles an hour.
Yeah, it was a Back to the Future reference. I had to.
Love it. Wow. So I'm wondering, all of these telescopes have basically been optical telescopes, right? Even though we had discovered the existence of non-visible light earlier, right? We've kind of seen these experiments that were done by breaking up sunlight into using a prism into a spectrum and measuring the temperature of the light just beyond the red end of the spectrum. The infrared light was discovered because it was like, we can't see anything, but we can feel that there is a temperature difference due to this incident light. But we're just still talking about optical telescopes, right?
Right. The radio telescope is coming up very soon in this little timeline. In the early 1900s is when this is, we have already now gone to the 1800s. Forget Doc Brown in 1885. 1895, the Yerkes or Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin became home to the largest refracting telescope ever built with a 40-inch lens. And it was used to for detailed observations of stars and planets and sometimes planetary weather. But just a few decades after that, that's when Kavi's entire industry came to be. The field of radio astronomy began when, you know his name, Come on.
Carl Jansky.
Carl Jansky, otherwise known as BKJ. He was an engineer at Bell Telephone Laboratories. He discovered radio waves were emanating from the Milky Way, and he rigged up an antenna and studied some interference or something, and there was a radio and stuck a thing out in the back and made a thing and in the backyard and with the guy and just nuts.
For folks who would like to have
I got
a little
it
bit
pretty good there.
It was pretty good. I liked it. And I don't think you technically said anything wrong, but if people are listening and they would like to know more about this, they can rewind back to, I think it was the start of season three, maybe our second episode of season three, where we did a whole episode on radio astronomy, and I did zero preparation for that episode, and it was basically a game of Benjamin quizzing me to see whether or not I actually knew the origins and history of my own field. So, yes, indeed, Carl Jansky.
Season 3, episode 2.
Oh! Yes, love it. So you can listen to that and learn all about radio astronomy and its origins and why I think it's super-duper cool.
It is super-duper cool.
It's also
optical
cool that
telescopes is just one kind. And there's other kinds. And there's also a timeline of other types of telescopes that have become to be. There have been solar telescopes. The very first made in 1904. Then there's gamma ray telescopes, which first came to be in 1961. And ultraviolet telescopes. First one was 1962. The first X-ray telescope was 1963. Way to go, 60s. First infrared telescope in 83, and the first submillimeter telescope in 87, and neutrino telescopes.
Did you say the first
submillimeter telescope?
No, the neutrino telescopes are a whole other wild ride. I love that neutrino telescopes are the only sorts of astronomical observatories that are actually located underground, which is fantastic.
It's crazy.
And that's awesome. But did you say that the first infrared telescope was in the 80s? Or do you mean the first space-based infrared telescope? I think...
Let's see. Infrared.
I feel like there was some like
the first
early
infrared
work.
Telescope was 1983. And let's see.
And she was in space, perhaps?
Spitzer Space Telescope was one. I think that was the first space one.
Yeah, okay. Because so, I think that we did have the ability to do some infrared astronomy from the ground.
Right.
But it was like near infrared. It was, I think, also in the early 60s, but like it was really extremely limited by what wavelengths could actually pass through the atmosphere. So ground-based infrared was not so much. Wasn't so good.
That's why there's one on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, as high up as you can get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a friend who works with a telescope in Mauna Kea.
Actually there, or just dials in from the internet?
Most people, with all these remote observatories and Mauna Kea or in Chile, which, you know, they're high up, high altitude, dry on top of mountains. Generally they have like a telescope operator who switches out in shifts, but most people just use it remotely. Yeah.
Which is awesome because knowledge has to be shared to everybody, and that's wonderful, and I want everyone to learn. But what a drag. Especially for the Hawaiian telescope. If there's one. You can't go to, but you have to talk to it.
I'm interested. So just going back to what you said before, outside of solar telescopes, it seems like radio was the first non-optical field of astronomy that really took off, and it was, you know, like 30 odd years before any of the other ones.
It was in the 1930s, yes.
Yeah. So that's crazy. But but the exception to that was, you said, solar telescope. So is that using a hydrogen alpha filter? Like, what sort of telescopes were they in 1904?
All I have is that they included filters and instruments to study different aspects of solar activity. One was being the Daniel K. Inouye telescope in Hawaii. Man, Hawaii's got the best stuff.
Hawaii's great.
Like, on several levels, some of them being telescopes. I didn't see
But that. Those are mostly on the higher levels.
What the filters are made of, though. But you're
cool. Yeah, I imagine they're probably optical filters, so it's still technically optical astronomy. But yeah, it's super cool. And I guess it's interesting that we realize that, you know, it's like, oh man, the whole rest of the electromagnetic spectrum, we have to send things into space in order to observe them. And that's kind of a really good thing, because if we did not have an atmosphere and magnetosphere that protected us from all the high energy UV and X-ray emission that's coming from space, that would be bad.
Yeah, we wouldn't be worried about observing things. We'd just be dead, cooked alive.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah. Do you in your work, do you get data from orbiting telescopes?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Big time. Big time.
Like
what? Okay. So normally the first thing that I do after I you know, so we have these big radio telescopes in Western Australia. The that's a traditional name for the land where the observatory is called Inyarimana Ilgari Bundara.
Say that three times fast.
Inyarimana Ilgari Bundara, Inyarimana Ilgari Bundara, Inyarimana Ilgari Bundara.
Give this man a prize. Go on. Yes, sir.
The CSIRO Murchison Observatory. For any future employees from the CSIRO who are listening. So like we have this, you know, massive radio telescope out there, ASCAP, and ASCAP is monitoring huge chunks of the sky at regular intervals and detecting hundreds of thousands or millions of radio sources regularly, right? And most of the radio sources that we see are AGN, active galactic nuclei, and then the ones that aren't AGN are things like supernovae or stars, and or like other weird things, right? And with the stars, which is something that I work on a lot, you've basically just found a radio source. You don't know what it is a priori, you know, just based on a single 15-minute snapshot of like the radio brightness. And so what you do is a cross match to other catalogs, right? So you have optical catalogs and infrared catalogs of objects that have been found with other telescopes. And the main one that we start off with, because of just how immensely good it is in terms of the sheer number of sources, is the Gaia catalog. So Gaia is a space-based optical telescope that has detections of hundreds of millions of stars. And it does, I think, what's called six-dimensional data. So every time there is a big data release from Gaia, and we've just had the third data release, DR3, so you get six dimensions of information on every star at a minimum, which is three-dimensional space, where it is, X, Y, Z, and three-dimensional velocity.
Okay.
Right? And that's just to begin with. You also have, you know, how bright it is in different optical filters, and that tells you, by comparing those, it gives you an indication of its temperature. The velocity gives you, you know, compared to previous measurements, gives you an indication of its proper motion, how fast it's moving, yada, yada, yada. So that's Gaia. Give you
composition type information as well?
The composition thing is a bit difficult to do just based on that, and it normally requires additional modeling. But
find something of interest from Gaia, then you go focus on it, and that's when you would gather its composition information.
Yeah, so it kind of, the way that I, at least the way that I do it, is I will try to gather all possible information. So I check Gaia, I check infrared telescopes, space-based telescopes like the WISE Observatory, which is, I think, actually getting decommissioned soon and is going to be crashing down through the atmosphere. Big sad. I use things like GALAX, the Galaxy Explorer UV satellite. I use the SWIFT telescope, which is an X-ray and UV satellite. And I use all of these to kind of build a complete picture of what the light looks like at different wavelengths. And, you know, not all stars, not all systems give off UV light. So if I see a UV detection, that gives me some information. The ratio of light that you might see in different wavelengths will also give you some information. And it's kind of like the more we study, the more we understand what we should expect. So how have we not done an episode on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram?
I'm writing it down now.
<He's>, for folks who are just listening, I see him literally. He's got pen and paper. The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is basically a plot, a figure that shows you the relationship between the brightness of a star and its temperature. And as I was saying, if you have the measurement of brightness in two different filters, that can be a proxy of the temperature. So it's kind of like color between those two filters. You have that along the horizontal axis or the x-axis. The vertical axis is the magnitude of the brightness. And there's like a very characteristic shape that the stars, when you plot them in this HR diagram, this Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, will have. And this is, you know, work that goes back to Cecilia Payne and Annie Jump Cannon, kind of like these early astronomers who were working in the US, even though they weren't technically given the title in the US and in the UK, I believe, actually, who weren't given the title of astronomers because they were women, but they did, you know, the fundamental work in figuring this stuff out. And so that gives you information, like seeing where a star falls on this diagram tells you what type of star it is. Once you know what type of star it is, you can figure out its composition, its mass, its size, and all these things.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, that was an unexpected tangent.
That's coming up in a future episode, folks.
I don't. Yeah, sorry for that rant and ramble, but I feel like how have we not spoken about that before?
That's why we do the thing. This is why we do the thing.
This is why we do the thing.
Look at that. Okay.
We have his attention. I like it. I like it a lot.
Dude, it's attention gathered. Look at that. Okay.
Wonderful. Okay, so we have covered everything from pre-modern glassware to early telescopes, and then going from optical telescopes into the realms of multi-wavelength astronomy. We haven't spoken about
telescopes in space.
We did it. Telescopes in space, but we haven't spoken about gravitational wave astronomy. But okay. I think we might have to. Do we have time for that, or do you have a question? What?
I have a note. Because gravitational wave detectors are not telescopes in the traditional or modern sense. They're very, 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 very new, and they detect ripples in space-time caused by cosmic events, but they're not actually seeing anything. Or, my question to you, is this detection technically the way these detectors see? That stupidly worded question.
It's not stupidly worded. I did have gravitational
wave detectors in my notes.
Well, I think that's exactly the issue, right? When we talk about, so you can refer to it as a detector, these like LIGO gravitational wave detectors. Mm-hmm. And then when we talk about modern astronomy, most modern telescopes at the business end, they have a CCD, a charge coupled detector, right? That's basically converting a photon into an electron, electrical current, and that's how we're measuring how many photons are hitting it. And so they're both detectors, but so is the sensor that you have in your recording studio that will go off if you don't have a hand motion. That doesn't make it a telescope, it's just a detector, right? So is that camera. So like something being a detector doesn't, you're right, is not making it a telescope. But I think what's really interesting is the way that astronomers will refer to the era of astronomy that we're in now that uses a combination of electromagnetic radiation in telescopes and gravitational wave detections from detectors like LIGO as multi-messenger astronomy. So the message that we're getting from outer space is coming through multiple mechanisms. Fair I don't enough. Know if that answers your question.
It actually does. It actually does. It does. I couldn't see anything in an infrared telescope with my own eye anyway. So we need some sort of a detector. Say yep. So to would that apply, I guess, to a gravitational wave detector?
Yep.
They just change the name from detector then to telescope.
Yeah, you're right, though. It's not a photon. I mean, neutrino observatory is also a different. Cherenkov detectors also different. But like we're delving into particle physics there. There are different aspects to this stuff. You need multiple types of detectors to kind of get a complete picture. But we should do a whole episode on gravitational waves. I love how every episode is basically a brainstorming session for future episodes.
It's a self-serving cycle.
Love it.
We make love an episode it. So we can get ideas for an episode.
It never ends. The wheel, big never wheel ends. Keeps on turning. That reminds me, so I'll try to find a gravitational wave astronomer who can come on and talk to us about gravitational waves in science. But it reminds me that we will have a guest in our next episode that I'm very yes. excited about. We'll be talking about science education, STEM education for kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very excited.
And the best part about this upcoming guest, just like our previous guest, Melody, she's actually an avid listener of our show, which is like great. So we don't have to try and win her over in the first 2 minutes. She'll be ready to go.
It's the same thing. We record episodes in order to get ideas for future episodes, but we also record episodes to create an audience to interview as future guests to create future content. And the cycle continues.
It's like growing like a virus, just absorbing everything. It's like that movie The Blob. Slowly absorbing people and bringing them into the fold.
Oh, God. This has been a very fun episode, especially the references to movies and TV shows from the previous millennium, including The Blob. Oh, man.
Oh, it's been fun. Before we go.
Yes. Yes.
Do we know where the word, I know it, where the word telescope first came from? Who first coined it? I have it.
Who coined it? Oh, I'm like, I know the etymology is the Greek. I don't know what Greek right. means, but
it is Greek.
Yeah. It's the Greek from telos, which means distant or remote, and scope meaning scope, looking at things.
Telescopus.
Yes. It
simply means far seeing.
Yes.
And Galileo was the very first person to have a telescope actually referred to as a telescope. It was
Galileo.
By a blah, 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 blah. I think a prince or something. Yeah, Prince Federico Sessi was the very first person to actually name this contraption Telescopus. Huh. And
interesting.
Galileo was the guy who had it. So Galileo, awesome.
Awesome. That guy. Galileo Figaro.
Figaro.
Magnifico. Yeah. Yeah. Benjamin, where can the good people find more of your science and comedy and t-shirts?
Well, when I'm not listening to Queen, obviously, you can find me under the name of Science Actually on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on what else? Blue Sky, Mastodon, Hive. You can find me on LinkedIn for all your professional types. and if you'd like to watch the show, please check out Science Actually's YouTube, TikTok channel, and check out The Nerd and the Scientist on YouTube. And you can find all of these shirts that I've been making. Oh my God, have I made many?
It's that same cyclical thing, like the episodes. We again, make episodes again, exactly. To make t-shirts.
Make jokes to make t-shirts. To get people on the show, to make jokes, to make t-shirts, to get people on the show. Good Lord. I'll go to, I created a Zazzle store, zazzle.com/science actually. Please go to scienceactually.com/podcast, where you can find all these episodes. And yeah, Kavi, I have a question.
Where can yes, you Benjamin.
You.
Me? You are?
Yeah, you.
Well, oh, me.
Yeah, hello. The guy on the screen over there.
Hello. Me and my duck can be found. I know. He's cute. For people just listening, there is now a duck on my microphone, which is why the sound quality may have slightly decreased. You can find me at Fun Fact Science on all of the good social media platforms, as well as all of the bad ones. I will not try to force my opinions onto you, which is which. And you can also find me on LinkedIn if you're interested in offering me or Benjamin a job. Speak to us on the LinkedIn. If you have ideas for future episodes, for future guests, if you have corrections, questions, quandaries, queries, clarifications, whatever it may be.
About the weather. Just
talk about yeah, that. Talk to us. We like talking to people. Reach out to us at Fun Fact Science or at Science Actually on all the good platforms, and we will be excited to hear from you, and we are excited to have you join us on the next episode of Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Thank you, everybody.
I see you have constructed a new lightsaber. Your skills are complete.